Welcome to Storytelling for Impact, the podcast about people who tell stories that change the world. I'm Susanna Birkwood, an international journalist and NGO communications professional with over a decade's experience working for some of the world's best-known media and nonprofit organizations. First episode, we'll be talking to the brilliant and brave Carlos Conde, an investigative journalist specializing in human rights in the Philippines. We'll be speaking about what it's like to do this work in one of the world's deadliest countries for journalists. Carlos is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, where his current research focuses on the ongoing war on drugs in the Philippines, which has led to date to the deaths of over 12,000 Filipinos. Before joining Human Rights Watch, Carlos worked as a journalist for 20 years, mainly for the New York Times. His job has taken him into some pretty dicey and traumatic situations, from interviewing state-sponsored assassins to children who've seen their entire families gunned down in front of their eyes. Now, I've seen the work that Carlos does from afar, but what I really wanted to know was, how does he cope with a job where the threats to his safety and that of his family are constant? And why does he do it? This is his story. Now, you worked as a journalist for 20 years. But then about 9 years ago, moved over to Human Rights Watch, where you've essentially become an activist. Why the change?
It had something to do with the fact that at around that time, the 2008 financial crisis, and a lot of the newspapers around the world were having trouble maintaining their staff and their contributors and their freelance journalists. So I was writing for the New York Times, at this time, and, the news hole was, shrinking and shrinking. So, the transition for me was initially driven by the desire to keep earning my livelihood. When I was invited to apply with the Human Rights Watch, I thought that was a perfect fit for me, because even when I was a journalist, I was always partial toward human rights stories. And in fact, if you look at my body of work as a journalist, more than half of the stories that I've written were on social issues and human rights. So it was something that came naturally for me in terms of transitioning from journalism into human rights research and advocacy.
Absolutely. And during your time at Human Rights Watch, you've done a lot on the ongoing war on drugs in the Philippines. You've covered press freedom extensively, a lot about the death squads and the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the Philippines, among many other issues. Tell us, how do you go about documenting these kinds of human rights abuses?
Well, I have to admit that working for Human Rights Watch, I mean, coming from this investigative journalistic background, working for Human Rights Watch now, was a bit more difficult because, the methodology with Human Rights Watch is much more rigorous, I would say. My journalism was not rigorous, except that, we have to keep in mind, one of the things that I was told when I was hired is that this is not just reporting about something that happened. This is reporting about something that happened so that that reporting can be used for advocacy, which is a key element in my new job. As a journalist before, advocacy was not part of it, obviously. But now as a researcher, using my journalistic background and the journalistic tools that I learned over those 20 years, the added, I would say mandate for that is advocacy. And this is where we try to, change policy or change things on the ground in the Philippines, so that human rights abuses are stopped or those who are accountable be held accountable. So so the methodology is much more different. So we approach every project from that, you know, perspective, that our mandate was human rights and international humanitarian law, and that our methodology should conform with that. So, you know, we tend to write very long reports, often book length reports about, specific human rights issues. And our interviews are, you know, we do quite a bit more interviews with all sorts of different people, different sources than I would have, when I was, you know, when I was a journalist. So it's a tougher thing to do, but also at the same time, it's much more, I would say, as I said, it's much more rigorous and much more scientific in that sense, because the gold standard for Human Rights Watch is that whatever findings that we can about certain, about specific human rights abuses should stand up in a court of law. You know, and that's something that's very important to keep in mind. So this informs our procedure, how we do research, how I document, for instance, testimonies of people that I've talked to. So it's not just a matter of, you know, just listening to them and saying this in the story. No, it has to really, you know, we have a very specific way of, for instance, documenting interviews, you know, note keeping, recording, verification, and that kind of process. So, so yeah, it's a much more, I would say, taxing method. But I think it's just as well that we're doing that, because again, we're not just journalists here. We're basically, you know, advocates, and we use our research to fuel our advocacy, and the standards have to be really high.
And you say you work with sources in a slightly different way than you did in your career as an independent journalist. How do you get in touch with sources? And who are the kinds of people that you're speaking to that inform your investigations?
Well, it's not really that different when I was a journalist. I mean, when I was a journalist, and I imagine this would be the case in many other journalists who've done what I've did, is, you know, we develop sources, we have a network of sources in, you know, in government and law enforcement, in civil society. And, that is the same thing that's going on, with my job as researcher with Human Rights Watch. But right now it's this networking with, this engagement with civil society. It's the thing that helps me a lot in terms of finding sources. Because we, you know, the way I approach the job is that, I talk to, a lot of people, you know, fellow advocates, fellow activists, and human rights defenders. And they're the ones, this network of friends in civil society are the ones that, you know, in our conversation, they would say something about, oh, this is, there's something that's happened in this province that needs to be documented. And so, you know, we then talk about, you know, that issue in that province, and then they would start, basically, we would brainstorm about, you know, who should we talk to? Is this NGO, non-government organization, willing to provide us the names of witnesses, for instance? And then we draw up a list of the names of people that we can interview, and then I set out to interview them. In the case of one specific report that I did, in fact, this is the first report that I did, when I came on board Human Rights Watch on the death squads in a particular city in the southern Philippines, I had friends in the NGO community back in the southern Philippines who had a friend in the police, and we sort of connected relationship with them. That friend from the NGO referred me to this police officer who I then interviewed and asked him about what's with all these death squad killings happening in your city. And then that official provided me with a lot of information and names of other police officers or names of hitmen that I could interview. So in that sense, it's no different from doing journalism. What's the marked difference, however, I have to point out is that because we work with other NGOs, and these are NGOs that have been working for human rights causes for a long time, we know exactly what issues are important as far as human rights is concerned, and so we feed off each other's we feed each other information basically, and then work from there. The Philippines has a very active NGO civil society community, and so this is much easier to do. But also on the other hand, I have had instances when just talking to ordinary people without any help from NGOs or some such groups, just talking to ordinary people in the streets or in communities the way I used to when I was a journalist would bring up a lot of information that I can then pursue into either a report or a short press release or a short feature story that we could use at Human Rights Watch. And I have had instances that happened. So,
what kinds of things, Carlos?
People tell me different kinds of things, but more often when I go to a community, for instance, in Manila where I'm based, and I go into a really poor community, often I have the exact idea of what I want to find out. So I would strike up conversations about, for instance, how are you here in terms of arbitrary arrests? Are the police harassing you? Or are the drug raids happening, are still happening, or have they increased? Things like that. And they tell me stuff. They tell me things which I then corroborate with grassroots organizations that work in those communities. Because often there are grassroots organizations that monitor these type of things. So they tell me, for instance, about, one particular project that I work on HIV and AIDS, for instance, is I went to a city in central Philippines that had been identified as kind of a hotspot for HIV infection, and just went around. I didn't have anybody in particular in mind to talk to, but I just went around and asked people about HIV and how worried are they. And true enough, they offered information that I would then follow up. So I think nothing beats, on the ground, research and reporting, for this job. So it's, and it keeps me, doing this keeps me grounded, particularly, right now, in the drug war, that's happening in the Philippines. It's been quite a challenge to, go around communities because of security and many other issues. So I tend to now, select more carefully the communities I go to, but I still go to these communities. So I still go and talk to people, not just NGO workers, and that type. So, it's something that I like to do. It keeps me grounded, as I said, and it makes me informed about what's happening, which are later on corroborated by other NGOs in terms of, the issues.
And what are you working on at the moment? It seems like press freedom is a perennial focus for you.
Well, it is. I mean, press freedom is a very important issue for Human Rights Watch and for me personally, because before Human Rights Watch, as we pointed out, I was a journalist. And when I was a journalist, I was Secretary General of the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines. And we have been campaigning, advocating for respect for press freedom in the Philippines, because you have to keep in mind, press freedom in the Philippines has been marred by our experience here of violence against journalists, and we are one of the top countries in the world where journalists are under attack. You know, this is one of the worst countries in the world to do journalism, in fact. And when I was a journalist, I mean, all of these killings are happening regularly. I mean, they're still happening regularly in the Philippines, and no accountability has been had by many of the victims of press freedom violations and media killings. So this is really something that we are serious about. So, and this is something that I keep working on, monitoring and just reaching out to former colleagues, in the journalism profession, and then helping them in their advocacy in making a noise about what's happening in the Philippines. So that's one thing. And so, and also the other thing that's, keeping me busy, obviously, in the Philippines right now is the ongoing drug war killings, monitoring the drug war killings, which is still happening and in fact has worsened during the COVID pandemic. And it's keeping me quite busy. And there are other issues. You know, I'm the only one for Human Rights Watch in the Philippines. So, and I cover the country as a whole, not just, you know, drug war killing. So there's a whole, list of human rights issues that the Philippines faces, over the decades. And I'm expected to, to tackle them or to monitor them at the very least. So we're not just talking about, you know, drug war killings, but also extrajudicial killings, torture, enforced disappearances of activists, mainly leftist activists, LGBT issues, women and children issues, health issues, and also, looking at just monitoring the conduct of armed groups in the Philippines who are fighting the government, because again, armed groups that are fighting the government, they fall within our mandate under international humanitarian law. So we do need to monitor the conduct of the conflict in the Philippines. And this is something that I've also been doing.
Wow. Carlos, just to bring you back to what you were saying about the journalists that are under attack in the Philippines. I mean, you're doing this work in a country in which at least three journalists were killed in 2020 in retaliation for their work, and which is a president who once said, just because you're a journalist, you are not exempt from assassination if you're a son of a bitch. Now, given the risks that you must be facing for what you do, why do you do it?
To be honest, Susanna, I'm not going to tell you some lofty thoughts about why I do this, or, you know, there's no higher goal for me. I'm not trying to be a martyr or anything. But I live in a country where violence is quite normal, where poverty is still rampant, where misgovernance is quite common. And when you're a journalist, for instance, at the start, when I was a journalist, the state of my country I've always been fascinated by it. You know, the conflicts, you know, the violence, the suffering, the poverty, the economic deprivation, the displacement of a lot of people. These things happen, especially because I'm from the south. I'm from Mindanao, which is, you know, if you look it up, Mindanao is like this, this conflict area for, you know, generations now. And this is where a lot of conflict between government and Islamic separatists are happening. This is a conflict between government and terror groups are happening. And this is also where the conflict with the communist insurgency is happening. This is the only place, that region is the only place in the country where all of these conflicts are happening all at once. So I was born and raised in that, you know, context, in that milieu. And I think that being from there, I'm naturally drawn to all, you know, to these issues. And because I started off, you know, even in high school, I was a campus journalist myself. I started my journalism, you know, in, working for, or as an editor of, our newspaper in high school. So I was already, even as a young boy, I was already aware of what's happening. So that I was drawn to that. And so I guess that's my very long-winded way of saying, of answering your question of why I'm doing this. It's become my nature. It's become, for lack of a better explanation, I think it's become my nature, and it's become something that I'm naturally drawn to. I get very riled up and, easily by injustice. And being a journalist and now being an advocate, is, I think, a natural fit for me. I have an outlet for my outrage. I have had an outlet for my outrage. And now, that's probably why I keep doing this. I mean, and also that, to be honest, I don't know anything else to do if I'm not doing what I'm doing right now. You know, I'm not some hotshot writer of fiction or a novelist that could give me a really comfortable livelihood. So it's all these things that make me do what I do.
I think that's fascinating. It's not unheard of, though, for Human Rights Watch researchers to be deported from countries or to face other kinds of sanctions for the work that they do. Do you ever fear for your safety?
Well, yes. I fear for my safety and for my family. This is something that, is always on top of my head. I mean, it's not just when I'm, just because I'm with Human Rights Watch, but even more so now that I'm with Human Rights Watch. I mean, when I was a journalist, I went into really dicey situations covering conflict and disasters and all that. And I feared for my safety back then, but now with Human Rights Watch, security and my safety is a very a serious concern within the organization, especially because Human Rights Watch, being one of the biggest and most influential human rights organization in the world, and this government and this president particularly is not very fond of Human Rights Watch. That's always been a concern for me. And the fact also that we're dealing with matters, we're dealing with issues that have to do with law enforcers, the military and all that, that adds to the security aspect of this that I don't particularly like. So we take precautions, although I can still, speak and publish freely, I credit that, I think, to the institutional credibility and heft of Human Rights Watch. I think the only reason why I haven't been targeted, knock on wood, unlike other journalist colleagues and human rights activists in the Philippines, is because I work for Human Rights Watch. And this is something that I'm thankful for every day that I do this job. The risks are real. And as you can see in the coverage, for instance, of the press freedom violations and the attacks on journalists, I mean, those are very, the brutality of what's been happening, people are doing to activists in this country is just amazingly, it's mind blowing, in fact, if you think about it. I mean, the thing that they're doing, for instance, against Maria Ressa, the attacks, the killings, the regular killings of activists, of human rights defenders, the people who do the work that I do, I mean, that's just, it keeps me awake a lot of times. It keeps me, I'd be lying if I don't tell you that I'm not afraid about the worst case scenarios, obviously. And my family, I have four young kids and a wife. My family, I try to protect them, insulate them from all of this. But obviously that's hard to do given that I have a very high profile in the Philippines. The thing is, they understand why I'm doing this. They understand the things that I do. And even though they'd prefer that I just be like behind my desk and writing short stories, for instance, they know that I won't be, as happy doing that. And so, you know, they understand and they respect me for that. And that keeps me going, you know. But back to your question about security, you know, we take precautions. And, you know, in my conversation with colleagues in the human rights movement and former journalists as well, we talk about this all the time, and the solidarity that we have, is quite amazing. And I think that's part of the reason why a lot of us, not just me, obviously, a lot of us are doing what we're doing regardless of the risks, regardless of the real possibility that one of these days, knock on wood, bad things might happen to some of us. And in fact, a lot of those who have been killed and targeted, a lot of them are our friends. And every time somebody gets murdered, an activist or a journalist who I've known, you know, a part of me dies. But, you know, the thing that sustains me is this conviction that if I give up now because of what happened to them, then I'm not doing them justice. You know, it's sort of my tribute to them, and it keeps me going. It keeps me, I don't want to describe myself as brave and courageous, but it's something that, you know, compels me to keep pushing on, moving forward and do what I do.
Well, look, I don't think there's a person listening to this who would not describe you as brave and courageous at a minimum. As well as all those colleagues that you've just spoken about. But I just wanted to pick up on what you said about the fact that you work for Human Rights Watch gives you a slight layer of protection that perhaps you wouldn't enjoy if you were an independent journalist.
I think the reason why that is because Human Rights Watch is, as I mentioned earlier, is huge. You know, I mean, in the same manner that the New York Times was huge. And these institutions have afforded me the level of protection that I need to be able to do my job. I think this government, regardless of, I mean, the really nasty things that it has done over the past 5 years, I'd like to think that it's not that stupid to harm somebody working for Human Rights Watch.
Having said that, though, that's not... you know, that's not a guarantee. That's not, that doesn't provide me 100%, you know, safety net or safety, you know, protection for me and my family. Because, you know, the Philippines is a very violent country. The Philippines, we have an epidemic here of hitmen and death squads and gunmen who, for as low as less than $50, can be, you know, can be hired to kill somebody. That's how bad things are here. And so while we think that this administration is not that stupid to order, you know, people to harm me, there's no telling that, you know, a lunatic supporter who happens to have a gun or a motorcycle would not act out on those impulses, as I said. It's a tricky thing, you know, because working for Human Rights Watch makes you think, oh, you know, emboldens me, definitely makes me want to do more, to keep doing what I do. But also at the same time, it probably tricks you into thinking that you're immune. And so that is the rub there. That's a problem there. Because once you start believing that because you were working for Human Rights Watch, therefore nobody will touch you, I think that's a very dangerous thing to think. So needless to say, I don't think that. So we have this quite robust security policy within Human Rights Watch that, you know, a lot of security boxes to tick before I could even, you know, go out and start interviewing people or, you know, travel to dicey places. We have levels of security that I didn't actually experience when I was working as a journalist. The organization is protecting its people, its researchers, especially those on the ground and in countries such as mine. And for that, we're very thankful. But we do not as a general rule, we do not let our guard down. We take precautions.
And Carlos, what's the most perilous situation you personally have ever faced doing this job?
Well, in terms of direct, you know, security concerns, I would say that my, I have had research missions where security was an issue, but I think the worst one was actually my first report in 2014 about the death squads in Mindanao in the southern Philippines, where I actually interviewed a few former hitmen. And so I and my team, I had a team of videographers who we hired clandestinely went to this city in the south and set up interviews with our sources, with people doing them in, you know, motels, you know, thinking that those are safe. We would go to our interviews in cars that are heavily tinted, and then would not stay in one place for longer than necessary. We hired some people to serve as our lookouts, security lookouts, in these venues that we held our interviews. And then the moment, there was one moment when we learned from one of our sources that the government had, had known that we were in the area. And the moment he said that, we finished everything immediately, the interview and everything, and went straight to the airport in less than 15 minutes. Because we're, keep in mind, we're talking about death squads here, killers. So it was, that was a very nerve-wracking experience for me and my team. But we came out, we got out of that, unscathed. But, after that experience, I became more, security conscious, if not even paranoid. So that, that week, when I got back to Manila, I ordered up my contractor to build a fence around our property.
Wow. I'm not surprised that you did that. And I'm curious, why was it that these former hitmen were being interviewed in the first place? Were these people that had changed their ways and were wanting to further human rights? Or what was the situation there?
Well, basically, these hitmen, the former hitmen, they were testifying of what was happening. They were ordered by government people to kill people. And so we wanted their testimony on the record, so that testimony against government people. That's why we were interviewing them. We needed to get as much information about their modus operandi. We needed to get more, you know, detailed, specific information about their hits, their kills, so that we could support the report by their testimony. So we had to do it. Obviously, you also interviewed victims, victims of families and witnesses, other witnesses. But, you know, it was the first time I came face to face with a hitman and with a few hitmen. And, it was exhilarating, but nerve wracking at the same time.
Exhilarating, but nerve wracking.
I don't know if I'm not even sure if you could have those emotions at the same time, but that's how I felt. And then, you know, I've been to conflict zones. I mean, covering the conflict also in the south, where the government were fighting Islamic separatists. So, but mostly I did not go in the front lines because we were not allowed to do that. There's no if there's no compelling particular reason for any researcher to go, in harm's way, we don't do that. So, I end up, you know, interviewing victims or refugee or evacuees, as we call them here, and get testimonies from them about what happened to them and who did what, you know, that kind of thing. But still, that report entailed travel to the south, and again, that presented us with some security challenges. Now, with the drug war, I mean, the toll to me as a researcher on the ground is not just, you know, this constant, constantly being mindful about security, but, you know, you start talking to people who have been victimized by human rights abuses. You start talking to victims of really horrific violence, and it gets to you, you know, and the toll on you psychologically, emotionally can be quite high. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues in the journalism profession, they'd suffered PTSD. And to some degree, I went through a phase in the past 5 years where I suffered some of that as well, you know, because it came to a point when interviewing people, particularly children who are affected by the drug war violence, was too much for me to bear. And that immobilized me for some time. And made it really difficult for me to function, and I had to seek help to try to process that, to be honest, I dealt much more this kind of effect on you of this type of work is much more, I think, I would say, profoundly affecting than witnessing for yourself or talking to a former killer. Just interviewing children and asking them about what they saw when their father was killed or when their mother was arrested or the police raided their homes and arrested everybody or shot their loved ones, that is quite emotionally and psychologically debilitating. And I haven't been spared of from that. And that is something that, affects many, many, not obviously journalists, but also human rights researchers from Human Rights Watch, because our methodology, the work that we do, necessitates us really going on the ground and talking directly to as many people, as many witnesses as possible. It's a very, emotionally taxing process.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that, Carlos. From my own experiences interviewing people in the field, refugees, victims of rape, it absolutely resonates with me what you're saying, and I'm sure it will with many other people as well. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the impact that your work is having and Human Rights Watch's work in the Philippines is having. And if you could perhaps take us back to an investigation that you're proud of and that had real world impact.
Impact is measured in a lot of ways, obviously. It's hard to measure impact in the work that we do in the Philippines because what we're facing here is not that, I don't think it is that clear to many people that accountability for the drug war killings, for instance, will be attained in the near future. I think many agree that that's not likely to happen very soon or even at all. I mean, the Philippines has a history of misgovernance and dictatorship and tyranny, and accountability has been one of the weakest, part of that, which is probably why impunity persists in this country. It's hard to talk about impact when that is happening. It's hard to talk about impact about the work that we do when every day people are being killed. Activists are being shot, journalists are being murdered, you know. But I would say that the situation on the ground in the Philippines would have been much worse if not for the work of human rights advocates and journalists in general. We're not just talking about me or Human Rights Watch. Certainly, I can say that we've been impactful in bringing to the attention of the International Criminal Court or to the international community the brutality that's happening in my country. I mean, to be sure, that process is, you know, even barely begun. But I think the fact that people in the international community, people in other countries are not talking about Duterte and the violence and all of that, and that they're trying to make, they're trying to find a way to stop the killings. I mean, that is impact to me. In the same way that talking to the mother of a drug war killing victim, for instance, and how this has changed her and how this has made her outraged enough to try to work for the cause of human rights, to try to help other victims of the violence. That to me is impact. It hasn't changed the way things are done in the Philippines. It hasn't sent, you know, a government official to jail yet. But, you know, little by little, you know, the human rights movement in the Philippines is chipping away at this, you know, brutal structure that we have. And that to me, is an immeasurable impact.
Carlos Conde, thank you so much for the work that you do. And thank you so much for joining us for these fascinating insights for Storytelling for Impact.
You're welcome, Susanna, and thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Storytelling for Impact. If you've liked what you've heard, please do subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. I'd also love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Susanna Burke Wu, and you can also find Carlos at Conde HRW. Join me next time when I'll be hearing from social and environmental photographer Jason Houston about participatory photography and how sometimes you gotta live with a community if you really want to tell their story authentically.